How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. In this episode, we're delving into the evolution of caring for heterozygous females with OTCD, and we'll see if I can get the name right here, ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency, which I think Dr. Baker will probably correct me on in a little bit, but I had to give it a shot. For those that don't know, this is the most common urea cycle disorder, and females with OTCD may experience variable and nonspecific symptoms, and that poses unique challenges to diagnosis and management. So, joining us are two esteemed guests well-versed in the unique needs of females with OTCD. First, we have Dr. Annette Fagenbaum, a metabolic geneticist with over 30 years of experience in the field who recently retired from Rady's Children's Hospital after serving as an associate physician there for over a decade. And as I mentioned, our second guest is Dr. Joshua Baker, the director of the Inborn Errors of Metabolism Program at Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. Throughout our conversation, we're going to explore how approaches to managing females with OTCD have changed as our understanding of the disease has evolved. We're going to discuss the nuances of OTCD, symptoms in females, and delve into the best practices for caring for these patients. So we have quite the agenda, but Drs. Fagenbaum and Baker, thank you so much for coming on and just educating myself and the audience about this. So I think, Dr. Baker, I want to start with, did I get the pronunciation right for OTC? How close was I?
You are very close. I would say it would be passing enzyme activity. It's ornithine transcarbamylase activity. So it's very close, yeah.
Okay. How do you pronounce it the correct way?
Ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency.
All right. I think I got a syllable off there, but not terrible for not
just
being
one.
In the field. Just
again,
one.
Again, that's still
all
a functional enzyme, yeah.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I love that analogy. Dr. Fagenbaum, I would love for us to start out just learning a little bit about urea cycle disorders in general and understanding a little bit about the dangers they pose to patients and how they're generally managed. I know we're going to get into a lot more details, but it's always helpful for the audience just to hear a little bit of an overview as we begin.
Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here. We all know urea cycle defects are enzyme deficiencies that affect many enzymes in the liver. Cells that break down ammonia to urea. And ammonia is in the form of nitrogen that comes from the breakdown of protein and amino acids in the body and is mainly produced in the gut, but also the kidneys and the muscles. A defect in any of the enzymes of the urea cycle, an OTC deficiency is one of nine components, can lead to hyperammonemia or high ammonia levels. And even if significantly high with symptoms, a hyperammonemic crisis is what we call it. And we know that accumulation of ammonia, especially if it's very high or lasts very long, is toxic to the brain. And that's been the target, the main target of therapy for the last few decades. So the higher and more prolonged the ammonia, the higher the risk or the worse the brain damage could be. These are rare conditions. Taking all the enzyme deficiencies together, the incidence is about one of in 35 to 52,000 newborns. And some of the enzyme deficiencies, what we call the distal enzyme deficiencies, we can diagnose on newborn screening. But OTC deficiency is a tough one to diagnose, since we're not routinely doing genomic testing, DNA testing for newborns at the moment. The risk of developing symptoms can occur at any age. So the classic example is a hyperammonemic crisis in a newborn, but what we're going to discuss today is much later onset symptoms, and they can occur well into adult life, and may be precipitated by some triggers that we can discuss if there's time. Anything that puts you at physiological or metabolic stress can lead to catabolism or breakdown of protein and buildup of ammonia. There are now a number of studies that describe the neuropsychological effects of chronically elevated ammonia or these urea cycle defects, especially in adult females who are heterozygous for OTC deficiency that haven't had hyperammonemic crises. And there are a number of subtle but significant features that we will discuss in a little while. The treatment, as I mentioned, is mainly targeted at hyperammonemia. And there are a whole range of modalities that we can use from restricting protein or just limiting protein to the daily recommended allowance, as well as supplementing if necessary with extra calories, amino acids, vitamins, minerals, essential nutrients. One of the main ways of making sure that we prevent a crisis is to ensure non-protein calorie intake. And we'll talk about that a little bit. And then there are medications, and there are a number of oral medications that are called nitrogen scavengers on the market. And they will divert the nitrogen from the urea cycle and decrease the load on the enzymes that are not working well. They're also intravenous product that can be used during acute crises. So those are the main therapies that we have on market at the moment. And there's research ongoing into future therapies.
And Dr. Baker, what would you add on to, and just in terms of giving that background about OTC and what we're kind of here to focus on today about what makes it a unique presentation in heterozygous females, what some people might think of as like females that are a carrier for the condition, but we're changing that language.
Yeah. And thank you for bringing that up. I think it's very important language that we sort of change moving forward in the medical community. So OTC deficiency, not going to say the large name anymore, is a disorder that's rather unique in the enzymatic field of metabolism, where most disorders are autosomal recessive. You need two defective genetic changes to cause the disease or disorder. OTC is unique where it's on the X chromosome. So individuals who are XY typically have a lot more severe symptoms than those individuals who have two X chromosomes. So individuals with two X chromosomes, typically we consider those female and historically have been known as carriers because they had one X chromosome that was unaffected. But we've known now over our knowledge and growth of what we know about OTC that these patients have symptoms that are very much from their enzymatic defects. It can be as subtle as intermittent nausea or headaches or migraines that happen during different times. Especially times with menstrual cycle, there can be migraines can be quite common, but then it can get more significant and impactful on these patients' lives. I would say one of them very common that patients mention is something called brain fog. I know that's not the medical terminology, but I think it perfectly states what's happening to them. There's this sort of aura going around that makes them hard to focus, hard for them to complete sort of higher cognitive functioning that impacts their daily living, whether that be schoolwork or their job if they're older. Other individuals have this enzymatic aspect that they feel when their ammonias are a little bit elevated, where they've selectively chosen a vegetarian diet. There's also multiple individuals that got in trouble when they were younger because they wouldn't finish their plate or finish their glass of milk. And these symptoms, though, change over time, which makes it very hard to lead to these diagnosis and treatment for these individuals.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a lot of kind of very general symptoms for heterozygous females. So I imagine that diagnostic odyssey is really tough because from what I'm hearing, you're not saying anything that's like, oh, that is a very specific symptom that would lead us to this. Dr. Fagenbaum, how are females with OTCD typically diagnosed? I mean, what challenges does diagnosis pose in these group of patients? Am I kind of on the right track?
I think you've pointed out a very important part, and that is that the symptoms are so nonspecific. And many of the females are diagnosed very late in life, either because of a family history or having an affected male child who has a more severe symptoms. Many of them, if you go back in their history, may have a history of milk protein allergy, like Dr. Baker mentioned. It's rare that females can present in early infancy, maybe not neonatal, but early infancy with hyperammonemic crises. But the vast majority are picked up during cascade testing of affected family members, or they've had an affected child. So we have a lot of education to do to try and pick up females before they have an affected male child.
Dr. Baker, I'd like to circle back to something you brought up in terms of like the brain fog of kind of being the general term that people use. Could you dive in a little bit deeper in terms of the neurocognitive impacts that even those that appear to be asymptomatic can have, and how this poses challenges in understanding the traditional way that the disease can present and how we understand it? Because a lot of these conditions, especially like we look at on carrier screening, we have said this phrase in the past of, oh, well, carriers don't have symptoms from it. But that has really changed. And I think this is a good example of that.
Yeah, this is very interesting, actually, because I think sort of understanding the aspect of affected OTC deficiency in females has helped us understand OTC deficiency for all individuals. There are many patients that have never had a hyperammonemic crisis who are now showing signs of very mild or those aspects of neurocognition that are probably related to their OTC that weren't previously understood or characterized as asymptomatic because they didn't have a hyperammonemic crisis. We now know you don't need to have a hyperammonemic crisis to have some of this neurocognitive effects. ADHD can be fairly common in these individuals. That brain fog where I talked about, where you kind of go through your day, especially if you have an aspect that you're not eating well due to an illness, or it's around your menstrual cycle, that you have this high protein load in your body, and then you're not able to focus and pay attention. And I think Dr. Fagenbaum even mentioned earlier that there's now publications well understood that there is significant neurocognitive testing or changes for these individuals who haven't had a hyperammonemic crisis, especially memory and executive dysfunction seems to be impacted. So it's really affected how we look at all patients with OTC and how we affect their management moving forward.
Yeah, so let's talk about the management. Dr. Fagenbaum, can you talk about how this has changed over time as we understand the disease better?
So historically, and that word has been mentioned today, carrier females with OTC deficiency, I really don't, and I'm sure a lot of us don't want to refer to that anymore, but we talk about heterozygote females. There was a time that I would say if the patient said or the female said that they were fine and they'd had no admissions due to the condition, I would say, okay, enjoy yourself. We should do prenatal diagnosis if you are interested. But other than that, no intervention was needed. But then with the patient's permission, of course, I would interview family members who came to clinic with them and really identified, as have others, that they are indeed symptoms, whether they perimenstrual or postpartum, or if they've had a high protein diet or just menstrual cycle per se. So yes, there are symptoms and those patients should be tested. And many times we have the discussion, should we put them on the full paradigm of therapy or try one step at a time? If it doesn't make them feel any different, does the biochemistry change and put them at less risk for a hyperammonemic crisis, which can happen at any age of stage of life? So I take a detailed history, a detailed dietary history that Dr. Baker mentioned. Many times I don't restrict protein, but I try to encourage them to lower protein to the recommended daily allowance. And then there's always the discussion of when to introduce medications if needed or supplements if needed. We do need better insurance coverage so that we can do DNA testing on all of these family members. But even knowing the mutation does not necessarily predict the severity of the disease. So there are shifts in approaches to management based on what we now know from the neuropsychological testing, and ongoing monitoring and surveillance should be undertaken.
And I would think that medical management for these heterozygous females may be more difficult almost with the mild symptoms in terms of, okay, what do we do? What are some of the challenges, you know, Dr. Baker, we can start with you, that you face and best practices for overcoming this for those patients that kind of fall into a more mild symptoms category?
Yeah, I think the first aspect is we have sort of moved to a field of medicine of really following guidelines and really looking at published literature to help do what we do to make sure that we understand we're diagnosing and treating these patients appropriately. But the lack of lots of guidelines and management and metabolism overall, and especially specifically the treatment of OTC females, is a little bit hard. You'll find that each institution, it's based on who trained you on how you might approach their management.
Yeah. Anything else to add to that, Dr. Fagenbaum?
Well, I think one of the big challenges is you're talking to a female who feels that they are well and they don't have a problem. And so it really needs individualized medicine and time and patience to encourage them to recognize that their symptoms may be related to the OTC deficiency and perhaps we can do something about it. So education, education, education.
Yes, which is what you guys are doing. Yeah. So thank you. Uh-huh. Dr. Baker, if we kind of span out a little bit, we were talking about the more people that are experiencing the mild symptoms, but what about just in general? I mean, current challenges in the management, and how can you share some of your experiences or best practices at overcoming kind of just in general?
Yeah, as Dr. Fagenbaum just mentioned, there's the category of those patients who don't feel anything or feel any different, and getting them to sort of recognize their symptoms or bring other individuals in, either that be family members or professionals, to show this is impacting your life and this is how we can change and better your management if we move forward with treatment. But I would say that I also have a category of females who are on the sort of other category where they've felt symptoms their whole life and feel like no one has paid attention to them or no one has really appreciated that they feel this brain fog, achiness, these other symptoms that are hard to pinpoint. And as you mentioned, very nonspecific. So they've been told their whole lives, well, we can't find anything wrong with you, that now all of a sudden they have to deal with often a little one who's diagnosed and how to manage them and then learn how to treat themselves that is shifting their whole lives differently than they had been before. Is the aspect of, yeah, the protein restriction that they might have put themselves on is often not the healthiest way to do it either. And they know, okay, drinking 2 cans of Coke make me feel better, but drinking soda all the time is not a healthy lifestyle. So how to unpack and how to redo someone's entire life is something that happens very slowly over time and often with a lot of help from a multidisciplinary team, right? Social work, dietitians, genetic counselors, nurses.
Yeah, we need interdisciplinary, as you said, to really get a lot of different people involved to really help this. Because as you said, it's very lifestyle. And for a lot of people, they're discovering that they have this genetic change because they have a biological child that's been diagnosed, that makes sense. And just in terms of like real world, what we're looking at and how patients are experiencing this. So Dr. Fagenbaum, let's discuss the unique challenges in supporting management adherence, especially in adolescent females with OTC. I mean, how do you address issues such as increased responsibility for self-care and peer influence? I mean, being a teenager is hard enough. So I can't imagine having teenagers be following certain restrictions and rules, you know, as it may kind of prevent them from fitting in to just kind of normal teenage life. And teenagers are already rebellious in general. So how do you approach this with patients, Dr. Fagenbaum?
So it depends on which category of female affected with OTC we're talking about. I think Dr. Baker's mentioned a number of them. I would add to that linking them up with the family support groups or who have mentorship programs and peer support. And they will find other individuals, because a lot of the problems with any of these rare diseases is the families feel very alone and they think they're the only one with this problem and nobody understands. And they sometimes don't even acknowledge the symptoms to the physician in the clinic or the genetic counselor. But if they're on Facebook pages and chat lines, they say, oh, that's me. Okay, and that helped. Okay, let's go back and discuss it. So really, education of self-recognition of early symptoms before they get into crisis, a good explanation of why we need the clinic visits and the lab tests. I like to start, if an infant has had symptoms and is already on treatment, so that could be female heterozygotes, I like to start transition planning really early, as in, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, where they can start reading labels or mixing their formula or measuring out their medications, as long as they can count under supervision. So we get them really involved in their own self-care. And I've mentioned the family groups and also participating in research projects really engages the whole family. And that can be very helpful. So the longitudinal study for the Urea Cycle Disease Consortium actually enrolled a number of exactly the female heterozygotes that we're talking about who really didn't feel that they have symptoms, and they are being studied quite closely.
Yeah, when people can be involved as a partner in research, I think that is a motivating factor, that they have a direct, you know, control of things that are happening a little bit more than maybe they felt in the past. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then I think another helpful thing is an emergency letter. So it's not to put fear into them, but for them to recognize that there is a risk and they need to address the symptoms early and get extra help, as well as engaging other subspecialists. So one of the experiences we had was a heterozygote woman who was pregnant. She had not had a hyperammonemic crisis since age 11, but she was now in her 20s and she was pregnant. So we had to engage the anesthetist, the obstetrician, the gynecologist, the ICU at the adult institution. And it really takes a team, a multi-D team, a multi-specialist team, as well as support groups. And the other thing that I do encourage is that they, adults or teenagers that are away from their parents, should wear a medic alert bracelet. And that not only engages them, but you know, a lot of people wear medic alert bracelets like allergies, and we can say this is an allergy to stress, protein, infection, illness, whatever, and try and explain it to them that way.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful, definitely. Dr. Baker, on your end, what strategies do you find effective in supporting management adherence for adult females? Because Dr. Fakenbaum was more focused on the teenagers, but anything that's different or the same?
The adult females, I think that the one nice thing as we live in 2024, we have a lot of technology help us go about our day, especially if an adult female managing little ones at home, and it's hard to focus and take care of yourself. There's different apps that help track your medications. Even a diet, if they're not on a dietary treatment, still watching your diet and making sure you're getting enough calories in, the right amount of protein can sometimes be good, so that you're not following that, you know, that controversial mom diet where you're just eating what the toddler doesn't finish, that you need to make sure that you're eating balanced meals to keep yourself healthy. And one thing that I found helpful, and I think I learned this from another physician and others have taught each other, is really scheduling the appointment for each patient individually. So the mom of a patient should not be lumped in with their children who also affect it. Because honestly, we spend the whole time talking about the cute baby and she needs her separate appointment. The female OTC has just as many symptoms, concerns that will be taken away if we're focused on that child. I like to tell my patients it's a little mini vacation. Make sure grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle, someone is watching the little one so you can come and have your private time at the office and make sure we're getting your medical needs addressed.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think parents often are just like, well, let me focus on my child. And you know, that's very honorable. And I think if there are parents listening, which statistically there are, you know, that resonates with them. But, you know, that kind of analogy of put the oxygen mask on your face before others, like, you know, you need to make sure you're taking care of yourself to be able to take care of, you know, little ones that are affected as well. So I think that's 100%. really good advice, because when kids are present, they're certainly a distraction, a very cute distraction, but a distraction nonetheless. So, I mean, I'd like to just kind of explore a little bit of the future of managing, you know, heterozygous females with OTC, and if there are any practices that you guys see and hope that should become the standard of care, or areas that need further research. Like, this is your wish list, your dream. Like, where are we headed? Dr. Fagenbaum, you have thoughts to start us out?
It's an exciting horizon, and a lot of people are working on new therapies. I know that there's been talk for many years about having a home ammonia checker that can really be very helpful, but unfortunately that hasn't come to market yet. I think the awareness of doctors in the emergency room and other places to check an ammonia level every time they see a patient, child or adult, with a certain combination of symptoms that we've discussed is crucial. And we are still having patients missed with hyperammonemic crises because the ammonia was not checked. So those would be my wishes. More infrastructure in the clinic for, as Dr. Baker mentioned, genetic counseling and social work and psychology testing, neuropsychology testing, also very important in this population group.
Dr. Baker, anything else to add to your dream wish list of what's going to happen in the near future?
Yeah, I think that there are some publications coming down the pipeline, but some better aspects of experts talking with one another to make consensus on how we should approach and manage these patients. And then access to more education about these disorders. This is a great example about that there are patients still being labeled as care OTCs out there, because that's what they're learning in medical schools across the country, that we need to just get rid of that word and restructure how we're teaching this disorder so everyone knows that a female is at risk. Because if you catch a genetic testing, but it's not someone who's as familiar with the disorder, they may mislabel that individual and they're at risk of going into crisis later on. And then, yeah, just more support overall for these individuals. I think that Dr. Fagenbaum mentioned earlier, just insurance of not just diagnosis and testing, but long-term management for these individuals is really hard. It's unfortunately very expensive to have a rare genetic disorder, and how you move forward with managing that in your life with that condition.
Yeah, I think these are all really good considerations to be thinking about and looking just down the road at what is new, I think, in the space, and just, you know, how people with OTC are going to benefit from so much technology and research that is just being developed right now. So thank you both so much for just diving into all of this. This was really interesting, and I think it's really important. As you both said, I just want to echo that, you know, people are working in teams to make sure that multiple areas of their life are being managed appropriately in relation to OTC. And that education, so that that can actually happen, so that healthcare providers are aware of this, and for people that have the condition to be an advocate for themselves and their family. So I think on both sides, it's really important. So thank you so much for just taking the time to educate everybody.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.